This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, with the election just around the corner, we'll hear how officials determine when ballots get rejected. We'll also focus on a tight race for Congress here in Illinois. The pandemic has urban planners rethinking the design of cities, focusing more on neighborhoods. While COVID-19 is hitting all parts of Illinois, the effects aren't always equal. We'll look at some reasons why. And we recall an historic radio broadcast, Orson Welles' production of The War of the Worlds. It was meant to sound like a real Martian invasion.
So some of the things they did to do that were add very realistic sound effects, such as shouts and screams, and even down to the sound of the Martians' aircraft opening up.
It might have been too successful. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll find out what it's like to be a contact tracer. It's not an easy job. The pandemic has some urban planners rethinking their visions for the future. And with Halloween upon us, we'll recall a famous broadcast moment, Orson Welles' production of War of the Worlds. That and more ahead on Statewide. But we're just days away from the election, and every election, a handful of mailed ballots are rejected due to voter error. For example, a missing signature, or they're sent after the deadline. A record number of Illinoisans are casting their ballots by mail this year. Mary Hansen has more on how the ballots are processed and what rejections might mean for election results.
In a windowless office on the first floor of the Sangamon County building, a team of three election judges pores over dozens of yellow ballot certification envelopes.
The N starting the first name.
The fancy N.
The judges, two Republicans and one Democrat, check the signatures on the envelope against what's in the county's electronic voter database. One of the judges is Bob Teal.
The signature that was on file was written, and this one was printed. So they didn't match. So we're rejecting it for non-matching signature, and then there'll be a follow-up.
We'll get to the follow-up that's done in a minute. But first, the rejections. A new law passed this spring instructs three judges to review signatures and assume they match, unless all three agree otherwise. Teal says out of the hundreds they've processed, they've only objected to a handful.
We try to approve as much as we can, if we can find any similarity somewhere.
Previously, just one judge or election authority employee could decide to throw out a ballot. Brian Gaines, a political science professor at the University of Illinois, says the new method means fewer ballots should be thrown out than before. And that could be key for November's election. Already, more than 1 million Illinois voters have returned mail-in ballots, shattering records from previous elections.
With a lot of people using a new method, I think you would expect a somewhat of an increase in the number of errors.
Non-matching signatures or no signature at all are common errors that lead to rejections. The most common reason, though, is tardiness, a ballot postmarked after Election Day. Political observers are keeping a close eye on how these rejected ballots could influence the outcome of the presidential race in swing states. Gaines says they're not likely to determine the result in a state as reliably blue as Illinois. But for a few tight congressional races or the vote to change the state's income tax system,
I won't be astonished if that's a very close result, and then it could turn out to be that even with a pretty small proportion of rejected ballots, maybe they turn out to matter.
Data from the State Board of Elections shows that as voting by mail becomes more popular, errors become more prevalent. In 2016, election authorities threw out around 1.5% of mailed ballots. But this year, in the March primary, just as the coronavirus pandemic was taking hold in Illinois, a higher portion of voters opted to sit at home and fill out their ballots. With that increase, the amount of rejected ballots jumped to more than 5%. Still, Gaines hopes recent changes to the process and voter education efforts lead to fewer errors and fewer rejections.
We've had time to think about that and try to get institutions in place, and there's been pretty substantial publicity about voting by mail. Maybe the education efforts will pay off.
So what's the follow-up the election judge mentioned? Here's Don Gray, the Sangamon County clerk.
You're going to be notified within 48 hours to the rejection, and then there's instructional information on what you need to do in order for us to accept your ballot.
If the ballot is late, it's outright rejected. But for any other reason, you can fix the error, a process called curing your ballot. The notification usually comes by mail, so Gray says watch your mailbox after you've returned your ballot. By law, it's a short timeline. Election authorities must process the ballot within 2 days of receiving it and notify you within 2 more days if there are any errors.
If it was not a non-matching signature, which I think will be the predominant one, or no signature at all, you need to give us a signature.
But Gray suggests making an effort to avoid problems in the first place.
I can't stress enough, if you made up your mind on who you want to vote for and you're voting by mail, mark your ballot, get it back to us.
And he adds, take time to sign the envelope carefully before you do. I'm Mary Hansen.
The governing body for high school sports in Illinois is defying Governor Pritzker's order that the winter basketball season be put on hold. Pritzker made that announcement this week, citing a resurgence of the coronavirus in Illinois. But at a board meeting the following day, the Illinois High School Association board voted to continue with the basketball season as planned, starting in November. Pritzker warned that schools going ahead with basketball seasons may face legal consequences. IHSA leadership says it was blindsided by the governor's decision this week, which also applied to hockey and wrestling. The organization moved wrestling to the summer, but ruled that other winter sports can go ahead as scheduled. The IHSA will require masks for players and coaches. It was October 30th, 1938. Many who tuned in to Orson Welles' dramatization of the War of the Worlds were entertained. Others were panicked that what they heard coming out of their radio was describing an actual Martian invasion, as they had missed an opening announcement about the program.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza Hotel in New York City, we bring you the music of Raymond Raquel and his orchestra.
The production began with music, setting up the listener for a normal evening before urgent news reports broke in.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
I talked with author Tara McClellan McAndrew. She wrote about this moment in broadcast history. So, Tara, why do we remember a radio program that was broadcast more than 80 years ago?
It is known for allegedly having panicked America, millions in America, who thought that this was a true news broadcast about Martians invading our country. The newspaper reports that everyone across America, or many across America, were panicked and frightened have since been contested. It's clear that there were people who were very frightened by this.
It seems silly today that people would believe that this was really happening, but there are reasons for why that occurred, and a lot of it was the production value that was put into this program.
That's correct. And they had some of the top people in radio working on this, both in terms of the sound effects crew and actors and writers. And that was what Welles wanted. He thought that the original script was really pretty dull and boring. So he wanted it to be bumped up in realism. And so some of the things they did to do that were add very realistic sound effects, such as shouts and screams, and even down to the sound of the Martians' aircraft opening up. Another thing that made it so real was the use of what appeared to be real news bulletins. This was a technique that, although others were using it, Orson's theater did an exceptional job of making those bulletins sound very, very real.
Wait a minute, something's happening. Humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks, and the automobiles spreading everywhere.
You mentioned there were reports that the whole country was in a panic over this. What have you found out? Was that overblown, the magnitude of the concern that this program generated?
In retrospect, yes. Many who have studied this have come to believe that that was overblown by the newspaper media. And one of the people who studied this is A. Brad Schwartz. He's the author of Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News. He researched letters that were written to Welles in his theater after the broadcast. And here's what he says about the media exaggerating.
Over the AP newswire, there are these scattered, isolated instances of panic. Journalists at this point, you know, their print deadline is coming up. They don't have a lot of context. They don't have a sense of how representative this is or what the extenuating circumstances might be. And so what they end up doing is connecting dots that should not have been connected.
A lot of people may not know this, but Orson Welles is from the Midwest. He was born in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and he spent quite a bit of time in Illinois.
Yes, Orson attended a school called Todd School for the Boys that was in Woodstock, Illinois. And he went there for 5 years when he was a pretty young boy. And the headmaster of that school, Roger Hill, became his mentor, his lifelong friend, a collaborator, and kind of his unofficial foster father. And I talked to Hill's grandson, Todd Tarbox, who now lives in Colorado. And he talked about how the school really shaped Welles' theatrical abilities.
When given a choice, he would select a play that would startle rather than not.
For some people, something like War of the Worlds, the bad publicity that came about, you wrote about the fact there was legislation that was talked about after this to prevent such things from happening. There were threats of lawsuits. It might have wrecked somebody's career. It did not derail Orson Welles. He went on to much bigger and better things, and this may have been the launching pad for that.
That's exactly right. Orson was supposedly said the day after the broadcast that, well, if I had wanted to wreck my career, I certainly did a good job of it, or something to that effect. The opposite was true. His radio company, Mercury Theater on Air, received after this broadcast, which allegedly caused panic throughout the country, received a sponsor for the first time. And it was no small sponsor. It was Campbell Soup. And Hollywood got interested in Welles after this. As a result of that interest, Welles was able to go on and direct what many consider his cinematic masterpiece, Citizen Kane, which has gone down in many lists of the best of American cinema. So this ended up propelling Welles' career, which is not at all what he or his company would have expected that night after the broadcast, as they were terror-stricken and were accused by the media of having caused the suicide of people, the mass panic of people, etc. And in fact, Welles and his theater company had horrible expectations for this show. They thought that it was dull and boring. And the reason it was so good is because they worked so hard at making it more realistic.
And one of the ways they did that was, as you mentioned, some of the sound effects that were used. Also the way that it had that feel of another famous broadcast from that era, the Hindenburg disaster. In fact, they were quite aware of that when they put this together, from what you've written.
Absolutely. The Hindenburg disaster happened only 1 year before this broadcast. And for those who may not remember, the Hindenburg was an airship made by the Germans, and it was making headlines all over the world because it was flying from Germany, Frankfurt, to America, New Jersey. And when it was landing or mooring at its dock, it famously burst into flames, crashed, and killed, dozens. And there was a WLS radio reporter, Herbert Morrison, who did an on-the-scene report broadcast later about watching the Hindenburg fall. And let's listen to it here.
And it's falling on the morning fast, and all the folks between that this is terrible, this is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture speeding around it.
What happened during the production of War of the Worlds broadcast for Wells Theater was that the actor who played the news reporter watching the Martians invade, Frank Reddick, went to the archives in CBS, got out the famous, iconic Hindenburg radio broadcast that our WLS reporter in Illinois had done, and listened to it over and over. And he tried to copy it in tone, in pace, in emotion for the World of Worlds broadcast.
So 82 years later, what is the lasting legacy of the War of the Worlds broadcast?
Excellent question. I am going to let A. Brad Schwartz answer that again. He wrote Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and the Art of Fake News.
You know, the great fear that this show created among the American public was not that this was a Martian invasion, but that it was a demonstration of how dangerous radio was going to be to democracy. Because it's, you know, the late 1930s, people have seen what's happening in Germany and in other parts of Europe. They're terribly afraid that we could have an American dictator, someone who manipulates the radio the way they understood Hitler to have done, to rise to, you know, to a position of power in this country. And hearing the story that, you know, any number of people believed the show to be true and acted irrationally confirmed that fear in their mind. And so that ends up being what motivates a lot of the response to the show, both in the letters that were written and in a lot of the newspaper commentary.
Of course, everyone has a different opinion about what the lesson is or was still today from the iconic War of the Worlds broadcast. I like to think that one of the lessons is the potential of broadcast to make us think, to make us imagine. So that, I think, is one of the reasons that this is still such an amazing broadcast, because it did such a good job of making the unbelievable believable.
You can read more about the War of the Worlds broadcast. Tara McClellan McAndrew's story can be found at our website, statewideshow.com. There's more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. For years, urban planning has focused on downtown areas. But is that changing due to the coronavirus? And later, the difficulties of being a contact tracer. That's still to come on Statewide. Like the national scene, some Illinois counties have lower pandemic death tolls than others. Part of the differences are demographics, but Illinois' results also appear to depend on unified leadership. Winnebago and Champaign counties both have a mix of urban and rural populations, but the death rate in Champaign County is less than a quarter of Winnebago's. Jenna Dooley talks with two Illinois reporters on how the mandates are playing out differently across the state.
Parts of Illinois are seeing increased mitigation measures like shutting down indoor dining again, met with tension and confusion, all while cases climb. Christine Herman is a reporter for WILL, which covers Champaign County. Christine, can you talk about why indoor dining has been among the first places to see increased mitigations?
Yeah, Jenna. So there's a recent report from the CDC that finds going to locations that offer on-site eating and drinking options, that was associated with COVID-19 positivity. And you'll often hear infectious disease and public health experts talk about how there's a real concern about people being indoors where there may not be great air circulation, and that can allow the amount of virus in the air to build up and just make it inherently more risky. So obviously you can't eat and drink with a mask on, and that makes bars and restaurants just riskier places to be than other indoor spaces where mask wearing plus social distancing can significantly reduce the risk of contracting the virus.
What have you heard, Christine, from public health leaders in your part of the state in terms of how much support they're getting for these prevention efforts?
Yes, so I'll speak about Champaign County. So as we all know, this is home to the University of Illinois campus. Public Health Administrator Julie Pride has said repeatedly how lucky she feels to have so much support from local leaders and the business community as well. They've worked together to take steps that go above and beyond what's been required from the state level at times, even preemptively closing indoor dining around campus, like when students were first returning, and also working with the U of I on the implementation of its massive COVID-19 testing program. But she says she has colleagues in many other places, even neighboring counties and elsewhere, who lack backing from local leaders, and that deeply troubles her.
This job is tough enough in doing it in Champaign, where I have a ton of support. I can't imagine doing it where you're fighting against the people in your community. It's horrible. And we're losing public health people all over the country.
And that was Julie Pride, the Champaign County Health Administrator. Chase Kavanaugh is a reporter with WNIJ, which covers Winnebago County in the northern part of the state. Chase, we're seeing some of that dynamic Christine mentioned, lack of support from local leaders for public health guidance. The sheriff and some elected officials are telling constituents that there's more at stake here. What can you tell us about the enforcement of increased mitigation measures in northern Illinois?
Winnebago County's Republican Sheriff Gary Caruana says he doesn't dispute the effectiveness of masks, but he does take issue with some of Governor J.B. Pritzker's mandates. He told a packed crowd of business owners that he won't enforce measures temporarily banning indoor dining in Region 1. That's pitting health department leaders against law enforcement and business owners. This week, Winnebago County Public Health Administrator Sandra Martell says that put her in a tough spot.
We do not have the ability, besides issuing the closure order, to go out and actually enforce it.
And Republican State Senator Dave Severson told me last week that he doesn't agree with how the mitigation measures are hitting certain business owners the hardest.
So I think you're going to get many state's attorneys and many local governments that just are not going to enforce it because it just isn't right.
We recently heard from Michael Lifeheit, the owner of Rockford's Irish Rose Saloon.
And that's why I, like a lot of other people, chose to disregard it. We're not bad people. We're people who have our entire life savings and everything invested in our businesses. And what you will see if we are shut down is that all the local businesses will go broke.
Several restaurants in Rockford this week announced permanent closures due to the stresses of working through the pandemic. And with COVID cases rising and lack of a unified front among leadership, it's unclear how this will ultimately play out. But from what I'm seeing, there's a real concern about the healthcare system getting overwhelmed and more people dying from this virus.
Christine, you also spoke with a bar owner in Champaign. What are his thoughts on indoor dining restrictions?
Yes, I spoke with Doug Larson. He owns Joe's Brewery that's near the University of Illinois campus. He says it's been hard for everyone in the restaurant and bar industry, as we all know. They are bringing in about a quarter of the revenue they usually make. And he says he understands why the mandates are in place against indoor dining. He has even voluntarily limited dining to outdoors only after learning how much safer it is to operate that way. And now with the cold weather rolling in, he says they've opened up indoor dining. It's still allowed in this region, at least for now. But he's trying to do it as safely as possible, opening windows, running fans, even while the heat is running, to improve the air circulation. And Doug just says he wishes there were more support for businesses. He feels for those who are struggling.
I sympathize because especially small mom and pop restaurants are going to go bankrupt and they're not going to come back, whereas large chains are actually growing right now.
That's Doug Larson with Joe's Brewery in Champaign. And he says if restaurants and bars could get something like a bailout to keep them from going under, maybe they wouldn't be feeling so much pressure to flout the rules and stay open. And Governor Pritzker did speak to that point this week. He said there's still more than $200 million in state funding available in the form of grants for businesses that are struggling due to COVID-19 mitigations.
That's WILL's Christine Herman talking with Jenna Dooley about prevention efforts in Champaign County. We also heard from WNIJ's Chase Kavanaugh, who covers Winnebago County. The pandemic has put restrictions on gatherings, and some say this gives an opportunity to rethink urban living, shifting the emphasis away from downtowns. Natalie Moore, with member station WBEZ in Chicago, has that story.
Urbanism is defined as the way of life in a city, how it's designed and developed, and what that looks like constantly shifts.
Who would have thought that COVID would force us to return to a scale of urbanism that was tailored to the size and scale of neighborhoods?
That's Maurice Cox, Chicago's planning and development director. Since COVID-19 restrictions began in May, he's been thinking about pedestrians and the experience of place in the city.
While downtown is there, we're not as dependent on it as we were 6 months ago. I feel really strongly that the scale of urbanism, the scale of the neighborhood, is going to be one of the major takeaways post-COVID.
Cox is an urban designer known for his big ideas. He says, imagine if every neighborhood had its own downtown.
Where you could go to work, where you could go to get your weekly needs, where you could recreate, all within the geography of your neighborhood. I think neighborhoods have the potential to be the driver of the recovery and the driver of the urbanism that people want.
Quite often, resources are poured into downtown and its perimeter with splashy developments and shiny high-rises. That translates into vitality, places to eat and go. Residents in Chicago's Black and Brown neighborhoods have long felt neglected when it comes to economic investments in the city. Meanwhile, Cox's department is partnering with a Southside community group on East 75th Street to experiment with sidewalk life. The restaurants here don't have enough space to serve indoors, so from Soul Vegetarian to Brown Sugar Bakery, neon green oversized sidewalk pods allow people to sit, eat, and socialize outside. There you'll find oversized checkers and tic-tac-toe games, weekend events featuring African dance, a DJ, and the reading of children's books like Alice in Wonderland. I meet up here with David Scully, an urban designer with Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, an architectural firm.
Urbanism and cities should, you know, really be. It's about collective energy and collective activity.
Like what's happening here in Park Manor. There's been a lot of conversation from urbanists and planners around the country who see COVID as an opportunity to push for a car-free society and focusing on blocking off streets for weekend brunches.
It's more nuanced than that, and there needs to be more thought and specificity, focus on key areas and key issues versus just kind of making the blanket like, oh, well, we can do without cars now. Well, not really. Like, there's still a lot of people that still have to get to work and, you know, essential workers, like how are we, you know, sort of addressing that? People with disabilities, how are we, you know, sort of engaging and addressing their needs?
And thus, Scully doesn't want to see public transit services cut because ridership is down. And that's also a concern of Linda Lopez, a Pilsen resident and advocacy manager for Active Transportation Alliance.
We're at the intersection of 21st and Western. I chose this spot because I think it's at the intersection of a lot of different dynamics and the communities that I'm engaged with. So you have the transit stop, which cuts through Pilsen, Little Village, North Lawndale.
We're standing in an empty lot next to the Pink Line station and a row of blue Divvy bikes. With homeless people camped out in several locations, Lopez envisions empty tracts of land being turned into green space or affordable housing.
Every time I go into Little Village, I cross viaducts, and they're pretty much tent cities.
Little Village is home to some of the city's highest rates of COVID-19 cases. What she's hearing from residents there is the challenge of living in overcrowded spaces while still going to work every day in a pandemic. She's not hearing about eating brunch outside. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
You're listening to Statewide. It's been 7 months since Congress passed a $2 trillion federal stimulus package. At the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, some of that money was meant for local governments. But more than half a year later, they're still fighting with the governor's office in Illinois for their share. Hannah Meisel has more.
As Illinois heads into the long, cold fall and winter months, local governments are looking for ways to support local businesses like bars and restaurants hit hard by COVID-19. This summer, those municipalities fought Governor J.B. Pritzker and won the right to get some of that month-old CARES Act money appropriated by Congress back in March in order to give small grants to businesses in their communities. But the Illinois Municipal League says Pritzker's administration has been slow to release the money and has set up too much red tape around it. Here's the league's executive director, Brad Cole.
There's no reason to set up a lengthy process, pay millions of dollars to a consultant to handle it, and then blame local governments for why it's not being used.
Pritzker, however, says many towns haven't applied for their share of the money.
We need the cities to step up to the plate to make those applications.
Local governments have until December 1st to apply, but must spend the money by the end of the year. I'm Hannah Meisel.
Media outlets overseas are closely following this year's presidential election here in the U.S. A couple of researchers from Monmouth College in Western Illinois are involved with a project to examine what's being reported and how it differs from 4 years ago. Rich Egger has more details.
One of those researchers is Dr. Robert Hink. He's an assistant professor in Monmouth's Department of Communication Studies. Hink says they chose to look specifically at coverage in Russia, China, and Iran because those countries are typically antagonistic toward U.S. interest.
And so in that sense, they have, generally speaking, the most interesting or divergent worldviews or understandings of what's happening around the world. And that's what we were trying to capture there. How do these three different countries understand U.S. politics, both from their vantage, but also helping us understand or stepping outside of our own Western biases to understand how other countries look at the U.S. election.
And has coverage changed in recent years?
Yes. So back in the 2016 election, we saw that all three countries similarly framed the U.S. election as full of drama and basically decline of U.S. democracy. And they did so by really taking the candidates at that time, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and emphasizing how U.S. media talked about how both candidates were highly undesirable. So they had the highest unfavorability ratings that candidates had ever had in an election before. And so in that case, it raised these questions of if U.S. democracy is so good, then why is it selecting two candidates that no one wants? Fast forward now to 2020, and we see that although all three of those foreign countries, China, Russia, and Iran, are still negatively characterizing Donald Trump, you don't see the same type of negative characterizations on Joe Biden.
So what do you read into the difference in the way the elections are being covered, the candidates are being covered in media in these countries?
Yeah, so the difference is in 2016, Donald Trump was an unknown. And so in this case, Donald Trump was, foreign nations saw that Trump could mean a break in typical U.S. foreign policy. They were interested in Donald Trump's deal-making background, and so they thought that there might be new ways to be cooperating with the United States in ways that would support foreign countries' interests. In 2020 now, all three of our countries that we analyzed, they seem very tired of Trump's antics, and they see Trump's action as unpredictable and destabilizing on the world stage. And so at this point, it seems like there's a preference for some stability, a return to at least a modicum of U.S. Leadership, just to make sure that instability kind of declines around the world, especially when we're in the midst of this global pandemic.
You don't read into this that they view America as being stronger under Trump?
I would say Iranian media definitely doesn't view the United States as stronger under Trump. Although Iranian media, I would argue, is biased in their antagonism towards Trump and their relatively neutral, maybe slightly positive descriptions of Biden. Specifically, that's because Iranian media have very vehemently disagreed with Trump's Iran policy, specifically pulling out of the Iranian nuclear agreement. And they see that President Biden won't have the same type of hawkish foreign policy that previous administrations had, even going beyond or before Trump. In terms of Russian media, I don't think Russian media, I didn't see anything in the coverage that showed Russian media thought that America was great again. Instead, what these foreign countries tend to look at, and this is true both in 2020 and in 2016, is emphasizing the social disorder that's happening in the United States. So under Trump, they'll talk about how the Trump administration hasn't mitigated or solved issues related to African-American rights in the United States. They'll highlight Trump's poor COVID-19 handling. They'll also highlight how we're currently in a recession right now. The Chinese tend to highlight the economics a little bit more than the Iranians and Russians. So in terms of that portrayal, there's not a lot discussed on foreign policy, but there is a lot discussed about domestic policy. And in all three of the countries, in those three issues that I discussed, you see that America has declined or is viewed as weaker rather than stronger.
That's Dr. Robert Hink of Monmouth College. He's part of a project looking at how media outlets in other countries are reporting on the U.S. presidential election. Rich Egger reporting.
On the way, contact tracing. It's a key part of public health response to COVID-19, but it's not easy. That story's next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll look closer at one of the most hotly contested congressional races in Illinois and in the country, the 13th District. That's still on the way. Some frontline workers in this pandemic are people you never see. You may hear from them, though. Health officials say contact tracers are crucial to containing the spread of COVID-19, but only if the public cooperates. Eric Stock with WGLT reports contact tracers get public feedback that sometimes gets personal and sometimes political.
After Ava Roper of Bloomington got her public health degree from the University of Illinois in May, she wanted to put it to good use. She saw the McLean County Health Department needed contact tracers, those who get information from those who have tested positive for the coronavirus so they can call those who may have come in contact with them so they can get tested in quarantine. Roper joined the staff with more than a dozen others and had to learn on the fly.
I would say it's been hectic because we kind of just all started. We were all kind of thrown into this. I mean, one of the things about COVID is that, you know, we're still learning. Everyone's still learning. The CDC is still learning.
Roper now trains new contact tracers. So does Gaynette Hoskins of Bloomington. Hoskins now handles case investigations. Those calls are more probing because they need more detailed information.
You have to be a little bit more in their, like, in their business. Who were you around? Think back on this day. Like, what was going on? Do you remember if you went outside? Was there someone in the store with you?
Many people don't want to give their personal information over the phone to a stranger. Linnell Greenberg of Normal works in the health department's communicable disease clinic. Since COVID, she's become a full-time contact tracer. Greenberg says she's learned it helps if you can quickly connect with that stranger to build trust.
Either as a mom or someone who works full-time or someone who lives in this community who might have used their services in the past, I try and break that wall down very quickly so that I can get them talking with me and understanding that we're here to serve them.
Sometimes even that doesn't work. They often hang up or give out wrong information because they don't want the health department bothering them, or they have financial concerns. Stacy Hirsch of Tawanda is a health department nurse who has been doing contact tracing for a year and a half. Hirsch says sometimes the resistance comes from business owners who are afraid they may have to take workers off the job or temporarily close because of a potential COVID exposure.
If they're forthcoming, they'll give us all those contact people. It's just their employers not wanting to necessarily have their staff forced to quarantine. That could be the issue. So we get a lot of slack, and we have a lot of people who aren't very happy with us.
Gaynette Hoskins says there's another segment of the population that may not be forthcoming. She says she has to reassure immigrants their personal information won't somehow be used to deport them.
Because they are concerned, like, what does this mean moving forward, things to that nature. And I just want to know, like, I honestly just want you all to be safe.
Some of the pushback contact tracers get is from COVID skeptics. Linnell Greenberg says she never gets anywhere with them.
We see this as a medical issue and as a community issue, but unfortunately politics, because of the election year, has really entered into this. And so I have had pushback where someone will flat out tell me that this is a hoax, they're not taking my call, and they think it's a joke.
Melissa Graven oversees the contact tracing program for the McLean County Health Department. She says compliance has gotten worse since the pandemic began.
There is a portion of the community that has an inherent distrust in government, so that's why allaying those fears and building a quick connection is such a valid and important skill to have as a contact tracer.
That can be tough to do when people get verbally abusive. Stacy Hirsch has fielded those calls too. She says she tries to not take it personally.
I try not to when I'm on the phone with them. I maintain professionalism, but after the phone call, I've cried many, many times, and I'm not ashamed to say it.
Yeah, it is difficult work.
It is.
The job has become more difficult because a sharp rise in new cases in recent months created a backlog before the health department hired more contact tracers. Hirsch says it's been overwhelming.
I would be not ever leaving my desk. I felt like I was like trapped to my computer and to my phone, and I wasn't taking lunches, I wasn't taking breaks. I just was on the phone from the time I got here until the time I left.
Hirsch says because of the backlog, the department has had to prioritize cases involving nursing homes and schools. Others can be delayed for days. The health department has said if you test positive, don't wait for a call from the health department. Start your quarantine immediately. And you can't test your way out of quarantine. Ava Roper says that's the most common misconception she hears from the public.
If you test negative, that you are good to go and that your exposure is not going to lead to a positive result. We always want to emphasize to them that they still need to quarantine for 14 days, because even if they have a negative result on day 5, on day 8, they could still become positive.
Despite the hostility and avoidance they encounter when trying to do their job, contact tracers say they know they are making a difference. Linnell Greenberg says the coronavirus is especially hard for older people who have to isolate. She's made multiple follow-up calls to a woman who is stuck in quarantine at home and can't see her husband, who is in the hospital with COVID.
Making a connection with someone who is really isolated and an older member of our community, and she knows that someone cares, that's my paycheck. That's it right there.
Greenberg says she's concerned more people act as though life has returned to normal. Cases like this remind us it hasn't. I'm Eric Stock.
As harvest season winds down, one farmer in North Iowa is collecting data from his first year experimenting with a combination of crops and livestock. He calls it stock cropping. And Amy Mayer with Harvest Public Media introduces us to the man trying to improve upon old traditions with modern technology.
Zach Smith is walking through alternating strips of pasture and corn that he planted this year.
Well, this is our answer for putting diversification and multiple species back on the land, and we're going to have a four-ring circus, was my idea, of animals parading through, grazing, laying their manure down.
He's motivated by the need to reduce the environmental impact of conventional farming. Smith and a business partner designed and built a mobile barn that moves his livestock through a pasture area each day.
We call it the Cluster Cluck 5000 is the model name.
Goats and sheep chomp the tall sorghum Sudan grass out front. Pigs root around and doze behind. Then chickens pass through, pecking and keeping the flies at bay. The roof offers shade and is angled to collect rainwater. Smith knows pasture-raised livestock on a grain farm seems old-fashioned, but he's leveraging technology to make the revival modern and practical. Webcams, solar panels, autonomous movement.
You know, you could have an app on your phone and say, move the barn, and hit the button, and Siri would make the barn move ahead for you.
Smith's commitment to technology extends to his series of YouTube videos about the project.
What is cropping up? What he said, stalkers. Zach the stock cropper being serenaded by the cockle-doodle-dooing of our roosters.
He says his years touring in a band left him comfortable in front of an audience. But he's a fifth-generation corn and soybean farmer with seed and chemical businesses. Still, he recognizes that change is the future.
I'm part of the big egg machine, you know, and so it's you know, just like anything, it's the Titanic. It doesn't just spin on a dime.
He decided to put some of his trade bailout and coronavirus relief money toward testing stock cropping. His experiment pushes multiple ideas at once. Let's start with the crops. Key cooperative agronomist Ben Hollingshead has been following Smith on social media. He says the pasture plants improve the soil.
The more species and different types of roots that you have in that soil makes that soil more resilient, more apt to be able to hold nutrients.
But Hollingshead says the rub is this: no matter how good it is for the environment and the future, any proposed change can't threaten profit. Smith knows this. That's why his second goal is to cultivate customers for his pasture-raised meat. Practical Farmers of Iowa Livestock Program Manager Megan Filbert says it's a sound idea, but the meat's going to cost more than what shoppers pay at the supermarket.
You know, do the majority of Iowans care enough? Do they actually want this? And I'm not sure that's the case.
This winter, Smith will evaluate soil and water quality, and he'll calculate what he expects to be a lower carbon footprint for producing meat in his system. He hopes the result will appeal to customers' values.
And hopefully be able to achieve that with marketing to consumers. that want to, you know, have the experience of seeing their meat raised in this fashion and willing to pay for that.
He estimates a farmer with 80 acres could run 30 cluster clucks and raise 450 pigs, a couple hundred sheep and goats, and 9,000 chickens. But that would require hiring livestock and marketing staff, plus taking animals to an inspected processor. It could take up to 2 years and $2 million to build a new slaughterhouse, but the investment would foster Smith's third goal, making rural life more viable and appealing.
We're going to keep doing videos. You know, the harvest has come and gone. We've still got the chickens to finish out.
For now, Smith's got corn in the bin and meat in the freezer. Most of it sold. The 75 people who came to his September field day give him confidence stock cropping is resonating. He's filed a patent on the cluster cluck technology and hopes to attract even more interest as he continues sharing videos. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The race for Illinois' 13th congressional district is grabbing national attention this year after it was close in 2018. National analysts rate the district, which stretches across central Illinois and down to the Metro East, as a toss-up. Eric Schmid previews the rematch between Republican incumbent Rodney Davis and Democratic challenger Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
The 2020 contest for Illinois' 13th congressional seat may seem like deja vu for some residents in the district. The candidates and their platforms remain largely unchanged from 2018, when Dirksen-Londrigan nearly beat Davis. He won the district by a little more than 2,000 votes, and the results could be just as close this year. Ken Moffitt is Southern Illinois University Edwardsville's political science department chair.
This is one of the contests that's being watched nationwide. There's a lot of money flowing in on both sides from nationwide sources.
A big reason why has to do with the 2018 results. Dirksen-Londrigan came within 1 percentage point of winning a district that Davis won by nearly 20 points in 2014 and 2016. The close race in 2018 provides some definite advantages for Dirksen-Londrigan this time around, says John Jackson, a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University.
Challengers often have to spend the first month or 2 months trying to get introduced, and they have to spend a tremendous amount of money just getting their introduction out, and she starts with all that behind her.
Just like last time, healthcare is front and center of this year's race, and it takes on added prominence given the context of the coronavirus pandemic. Both candidates agree the country's current healthcare system needs reform, but disagree on how to accomplish that change. Davis says he would build on the country's existing employer-based healthcare system. He says he's introduced legislation that would subsidize what employers pay for healthcare for someone who may have lost their job.
That's a way to make sure families like mine, who are going through cancer or other treatments, it makes sure that you keep your same doctors and you keep your same medical treatment plans.
Davis says this would let employees pay what they have already been paying instead of needing to look for another health plan. Dirksen-Londrigan says she wants to strengthen the Affordable Care Act by providing a public option for Medicare, otherwise known as Medicare X. She says the ACA was a good first step, but she says some health providers have left areas of central Illinois, driving up the cost of insurance. Dirksen-Londrigan says Medicare X would bring back competition and lower healthcare costs.
The reason that I want to look at the public option is because we could actually work with the hospitals to make sure that they can maintain their excellent standard of care. And can we then provide some competition in those markets and bring the costs down?
The two candidates also share feelings about the way the United States responded to the coronavirus pandemic. They both call it a failure. Dirksen-Londrigan says the government needs to support Americans who are currently struggling by extending unemployment insurance and adding more money to the Paycheck Protection Program.
I do believe that we are going to get to the other side of this pandemic, but we need to make sure our families and our small businesses are still afloat when we get there.
Davis is more focused on preparing for the next pandemic threat by closely examining the failings this time around.
So that we don't see failures across government, across administrations, both this one and previous administration, and a decades-long problem with Congress not fully funding and addressing what a national stockpile should actually entail.
But Moffitt says the race will likely come down to factors that are largely outside of each candidate's control.
If I had to pick two issues it would boil down to, Donald Trump and the pandemic.
He says voters in the 13th district and elsewhere are choosing their congressional candidate based on the D or R next to their name instead of policy differences.
That's really a trend as far as congressional elections. that congressional elections in the last about 20 years have become much, much more nationalized than what they used to be.
This is something Jackson sees too. He says it's nearly impossible for congressional candidates to disassociate their races from the contest for the White House, especially in this year's election.
It's a nationalized race and can't be avoided.
That means whomever voters choose to go to the White House will probably have an ally from Illinois' 13th congressional district. I'm Eric Schmid.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week post-election and have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, if you missed any of this week's episode or past episodes, all of them are available at statewideshow.com, and our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Our email address is at our website. You can drop us a line, let us know how we're doing. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.